برای کشنا به سرگوت آده ایسی مدی باکتو بران دست محمد نیتی نامنی نمسته سارا ساده دیوی گوروانی پچارنی نروس کشی شنی مالی پاس آتو دیش تارنی سری کشنا چیتان یا پرابو رنچی دان دسوی دویت کداد هاش کسی گور باکتو بیند هری کشنا هری کشنا 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 هری 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 راما هری راما 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 هری هری So the previous day we talked about sadhana bhakti, and the definition was engagement of the senses in such a way that it leads to bhava, which is a direct manifestation of Krishna Shakti in the jiva. And so up to that point where Krishna reveals himself, we have sadhana. So those processes which will lead there, that is called sadhana bhakti. And there were two types of sadhana bhakti, raganuga and vaidhi bhakti. And as long as one does not have that raga, then one is obliged to follow vaidhi bhakti, which means obedience to rules and regulations. That's the impetus for us to do the activities. Rules and regulations coming from shastra or scripture. So, then we talked about the different angas of bhakti, the different limbs. There are 64 limbs mentioned in the nectar devotion. However, that is not all-inclusive. Rupa Goswami's picked those out because those are more prominently mentioned in the scriptures, but one can find more items than that. He's picked out 64. And of those, he's put 20 as preliminaries, which you must do before you do the other 44. So we discussed those angas, the door to bhakti, the first 20. First 10 were things you do, and the second things which you don't do. So these are very, very important, because if you don't do these, you cannot practice effectively the other angas. And if you can't do that, then you don't get bhava. The sadhana is not practiced properly, you don't get bhava. So at the very entrance, we had surrender to guru. That was the first item. Guru Pada Sahara, take shelter of the lotus feet of the guru. That was the very first point. And the second one is to take shiksha and diksha. The third one, let's do serve. The fourth one is to follow the acharyas. So therefore, this points out the importance of to surrender to guru and receiving teachings and mantra, serving guru and following scripture. Very fundamental for the practice of bhakti. So they're put at the very, very beginning. And they're also not lumped as one. We see that he's made, concerning guru, three distinct item angas he's made there, not just one. Okay. Surrender to guru, or not just take diksha, or not just serve guru. He made three different angas to emphasize the point that all these items in themselves are important. We can say that, many of the items later on in the 44 have to do with deity worship. So we can classify maybe out of the 44, at least 20 are related to deity worship. So we can say they're sabangas of archana. But he's put them as separate items. So similarly, we can say these are all items of, let's say, concerning guru, but he's made three separate items out of them to emphasize the fact that it's very important. That each item in itself is very important. So the surrender is important, the service is important, and the perception of mantra and knowledge is also very important in order to perform bhakti properly. First 20 angas we covered. Any question on the first 20 angas?
Are the examples that come from simply hard on the hereditary
feature? It's hard to say like that because not so much is recorded, but let's say as far as our prominent acharyas are concerned, they all got diksha, which means the mantras, which means our second initiation. This classification of dividing into two parts basically came with Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati. whether he gave a first Harinam and then a second Diksha. So that's where that comes from. Before that, there was not such a distinction, a formal distinction. People would chant Hare Krishna, they may accept someone as, you know, a teacher or whatever. We can say it's like the holy name, but there was no official anything. They probably didn't give him a name also. Huh? And when you say Diksha, then they would do all, give the name, give the mantra at that time. And that would be their Diksha. So emphasis is more on Diksha as far as formality was concerned. Huh? Therefore, we don't get that the quite, you know, two formal stages like we have now. I don't know. We can look that up maybe and see about that. Generally, they did, however. We'll see that most of them did. Of course, we can say Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami, did they have a Diksha Guru? Because we don't see an actual Diksha Guru mentioned anywhere. Of course, Lord Chaitanya gave them names. We can say that. But did he give the mantra? That we don't know. Huh? I don't know whether it's written anywhere. They got mantra from anyone. Huh? That's also maybe they didn't. In which case, they just chanted Hare Krishna. Nevertheless, in the books, they're saying you take Diksha and Shiksha. Huh? Huh? So it's generally recommended. Huh? But then the problem would come, how do they worship their deities? Because they did have deities. So then they need mantra. But then maybe one reason we don't see Diksha as such mentioned with them and such. Well, that couldn't be a reason either. No. No, I don't think so. I was going to say because they were contaminated by the Muslims, therefore they maybe felt a little bit awkward about taking Diksha, but that's not a restriction in Pancharat, theoretically at least. It may have been in terms of social etiquette at the time. Huh? Because we see the Haridas Thakur generally, there's a mention that he did take Diksha one place, but generally they assume he didn't. He never tried to enter the Jagannath temple or anything, just stayed away. He didn't bother to, you know, interfere with the social system at that time because they would obviously harass him if he tried to enter because he was a Muslim. So caste consciousness was there. So even though Rupa and Sanatana Goswami were great devotees to the Lord and didn't recognize that, still they also knew they were contaminated by the Muslims at a certain point in time, and certain people would not actually, the smartest, would not go near them for that reason. As far as Vaishnavas are concerned, we don't care. Therefore, they would also criticize them also for worshipping deities, etc. No? But we see they did worship also. So, perhaps they did take Diksha. But I don't know if there's any, you know, real authoritative, source for their Diksha Guru who gave mantra. Why we have two things? I don't really know what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said about it, what is the justification for that. But if we look at it, it's a practical way of bringing people up gradually to higher qualification where they can get the mantra. So one can do it informally, or one can do that formally. So he just made it more or less formal. Though the chanting the holy name is free, you don't have to, you know, have any qualification in one sense. Doesn't depend on Diksha. Still, the acharyas always emphasize that one has to have Shiksha anyway, even for that. Otherwise, one continues in Namabhas, so one needs knowledge. Therefore, one needs someone to give the knowledge, so we need a guru of some sort. So therefore, there's what is called Nam Guru, one who explains the glories of the holy name and the Nam Tattva, or the, you know, philosophy of the holy name and Krishna, etc., gives someone the gyan so that one's chanting can be effective. Yeah? So we can say that the Nam Guru in one sense is like Diksha, or like, you know, first, what we call first initiation. So technically you only have one Diksha. Only for a second, one has to have more knowledge, more steadiness, etc. Huh? In other words, we chant and then we see how steady you are and sincere you are, and then after we, you know, see that, then we can say, okay, take the mantra. So before that time, they didn't do that. They would just, people would come and then they would associate and see for some time without giving them a first initiation, whatever. And then when they're ready, then they would just give them second, or what we call second, what they call diksha. So it's just like a, it's a, we can say it's an encouragement to make a formal, you know, giving you the holy name. And just puts them above the casual level and prepares them for diksha. But that, actually, that is through the mantra, the distinguishing factor there is through mantra, because even a Shiksha Guru gives Divya Gyanam. Yeah. We get our relationship with Krishna revealed through the mantra in that case. And then after that, then we do deity worship. So there's Krishna revealed there also. That's Divya Gyanam also. And through that, of course, then ignorance is destroyed also. But, yeah, Shiksha Guru can also give knowledge. He won't give mantra or deity worship, but he'll give knowledge, which is also purifying. And we practice bhakti, and that also destroys sins. Yeah? So we can get it from both sources. Okay. So now we'll go on to the other angas of bhakti. Rupa Goswami has divided them up according to, generally, according to the senses. So first of all, he's mentions some concerning the whole body, and then voice, and taste, and smell, touch, and sight, hearing, and then mind, and some other ones which are more or less mixed. And then he concludes by saying five are most powerful or potent. So that is because he's already mentioned that the definition of sadhana bhakti was you engage the senses. So therefore, he classifies the different senses and then mentions the different angas you can do. So these are very straightforward. Many of them are straightforward. Many of them also look a little bit incidental in one sense, as an anga. For instance, putting tilak on, or you know, writing the holy names on the body. These are actually angas of bhakti, in relation to the whole body. Like that. But he mentions these because these are glorified in the shastras as angas, and they do have some. Everything has its significance, even though it may not look so significant, like this tilak. Whether we have tilak or not, would Krishna recognize us ultimately if we had devotion? You know, yes, even if it wouldn't matter what we're wearing and what we have on our face, still he'll recognize our bhakti. So in that sense, it's not so important. Nevertheless, we see that all the scriptures mention about this. They mention these things and glorify them, saying that, you know, by putting the tilak on, then you go to the spiritual world, etc., and you're saved from Yamaraj. You have all sorts of glorifications like this. So we have to understand it does have some sort of significance as far as we are concerned in the material world to help us advance in devotional service, though it may not look very apparent. So just for instance, the tilak, for instance. Of course, our tilak also is very special because of Gopi Chandan and, let's say, the gopis. Bodies, let's say, the clay representing the gopis' bodies. Also, the it has symbolism, of course. And different symbolisms are there. One is the foot of the Supreme Lord, so it's surrendered to the Supreme Lord. Another point about tilak is generally tilaks are they signify which group you belong to. Of course, all Vaishnavas should have vertical tilaks, but then we have the Sri Vaishnavas and the Madhvas and whatever. And then even among the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, you have differences. Eh? So those followers of Advaita will have a certain type of tilak. Those followers of Nityananda will have a different one. Followers of Shamananda, a different one. That's the Nupur Tilak. Huh? So each group will have a different. Gadadhar will have another one. Gadadhar's well line will have a different Tilak. Huh? So therefore, it also distinguish a particular, not only Gaudiya Vaishnavas, but among the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, a particular line that you fall in, and it helps you identify your parampara, so to speak. So that's, of course, external, but it helps you identify your line. Huh? So if we have this one here, like this particular, then we know that all belong to Bhaktisiddhanta's line. And it's a little different, then we know there's some other line. Huh? So that's a way of distinguishing one's group as well. Of course, the tilak marks are, we say, universal, even among Shivais, they also wear tilak, and then among Vaishnavas, Sri Vaishnavas, Madhavas also wear tilak, and also in the same places. So there's also some significance to that. It's not explained so much in Shastra, but it looks a little obvious in one sense. Because we have tilak on this area here, on this, on the sides, in the back, and we have tilak here, and we have one on the back, we have here, 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 and here. And then, of course, we have here and here. So this basically follows the chakras, we can say, around the waist side, the chest, around here and the back and here, and then head. So basically it follows the chakras also. Yeah? Not just to represent the chakras, but also to, we can say, stimulate the chakras. Because touch is also a form of stimulation. So when you say your mantra and touch, then it stimulates the different areas of the body. Yeah? So that chakra means a subtle energy vortex or center. It's important for the physical body, and it's also important for the mental body, because it's actually the chakras are on the mental body, not on the physical body, than the subtle body. But they do affect the gross body. So if the chakras are disturbed, you can get physical defects. But if they're disturbed, obviously you can have mental defects also, because it's on the subtle body. So therefore, one should keep one's chakras, and therefore subtle body, in good condition in order to practice bhakti. Because if your mind is disturbed, you cannot practice. If your physical body is disturbed, you cannot practice. So the touching is one way of putting things in order. As long as the touch is done with the proper mentality, and let's say, in our case, we're chanting the names of Vishnu. So it becomes all auspicious. So not only is it physically, let's say, purifying in the sense of a doctor would purify you physically, but also we have the added item of the name of Vishnu, which is not only purifying, but it's spiritualizing. Yeah? So therefore, when we say the name of Vishnu on the different chakra centers, whatever, then that's also spiritualizing our whole subtle body and helps us think of the Supreme Lord. So it purifies physically on the gross and subtle levels of the body, and then it spiritualizes so we can concentrate on the Supreme Lord more. That's one function. The other function is, we can say, protective. And one sees the example in the 10th canto of Bhagavatam after Krishna was attacked by Putana, and she tried to kill him with her poison, and then he sucked her life air out, and then she died, and she ran out of the house and crashed down on the ground, expanded into a big rakshasi, and Krishna was lying on top of her playing, and then all the gopas and gopis came out, and they were horrified, and they saw Krishna in this position, and they grabbed him and took him away and burned the body up of Putana. And then they thought of ways of giving Krishna protection, because this big demons, Rakshasi, had come. So what they did is they chanted the names of, touched the parts of Krishna's body, and they chanted the names of Vishnu all over his body to protect him. Similarly, we have the Narayan Kavacha, where you take the syllables of Om Namo Narayana and stick it all over your body as a protection. So therefore, this also acts as a protection for the devotee. We invoke Vishnu around the body. Not that we're trying to use Vishnu as our protection, but rather than use anything material, we also understand, you know, Supreme Lord is our protector, so we're not really asking, but we do this, and this helps us in our devotional service. So it protects us and also keeps out the, you know, material influences. So it may look a little bit insignificant, because we're just, you know, touching the body and putting names on the body. But the name of the Lord is all-powerful, it's spiritual, and if it's done with the proper mentality, then it will spiritualize the physical and the subtle body, and help us concentrate on the Lord and keep away, you know, the other materialistic entities around us. So that is one aspect of the tilak. You know, so it's for our good, in other words, to put on the tilak and chant the names of Vishnu. protective and also good for our meditation, and good for physical and mental well-being. This is not Shastra, but it's just some idea I have, so I mentioned it. okay, so we have the different bodily items on there. Among the whole body, another one is offering obeisances. this, of course, is a common anga. We have many prayers. So-and-so, like Krishnaya Namaha or Vishnave Namaha or whatever. This is Namaha, so the accompanying physical action is the pranam, in which you bow down either on the knees with the hands or else full on the floor. Eight-limbed one or six-limbed one. What this means is that this is a type of surrender. It is physical, of course, but in the process of doing this physical one, we're also doing something mentally also. So the asanga pranam, or the eight, among the eight parts, not only the physical parts, like the feet and the knees and the chest and the hands, but also the mind. That's one of the angas that has to go down also. Mind has to go down. Eyes also. And voice. So, what do we do with the mind? How do we pronounce with the mind? Put ourselves at the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. And it goes in the mind. The eyes, is, as they say, half close the eyes. Voice, you say the pranam, so-and-so namaha. So we're paying obeisances with the mind, body, and words when we do the ashtanga pranam. So in other words, it's a practice. We're practicing surrender by engaging the senses in the body. Okay. And there's a controversy, of course, that women should not do the full pranam on the ground. and that is quite common in North India and in South India also, in general. But we see exceptions to that also. We see exceptions to that. Even in some temples, you'll see the sponsors, the men and women on the in the stone, actually. They're engraved in the stone, laid out on the ground, everyone stepping all over them in the temple, as donors of the temple, you know, lying on the ground. But it's quite common now that the women don't go full on the ground. Other bodily ones, things like parikrama, going around the temple or around the deity. This is also one anga of bhakti. That's why we do parikramas around the deity. Generally, around the deity room, you have a place to go around, like in our temple here. So this is one anga of bhakti. That is actually a type of respect. To go around, you circle around an important person. So when Brahma sees Krishna, then he'll walk around him, and then he pays obeisances, then he'll leave. Like that. So it's a form of respect going around like this also. Of course, we can do parikrama of the deity or parikrama of the Dhamma also, going around the whole Dhamma. Therefore, we have Navadi Dhamma parikrama, going around the whole Dhamma, or Vrindavan parikrama, going around the Dhammas. So this is engaging the body and the feet, basically. Then we have ones like just going to the temple. That's one. Walking to the temple, using your feet to go to the temple. That's an anga bhakti also. So we engage the feet. Another one is rising up and following the deity. When in many temples every morning, they will take the small form of the deity out of the deity room and they'll go around the whole temple. Or wider area than that, like almost like a Rath Yatra, you know, but they just carry the deity and go out and go around. And similarly in Rath Yatra, you respect by standing up and following after the procession. So that's another anga bhakti. So these are all glorified, and by doing any of these acts, because they are related to the Lord, they're respectful to the Lord, And if done with the proper mentality, that is, you know, service attitude, then any of these angas can take us back to the Supreme Lord. They're that powerful. Generally, of course, we don't see it immediately. We have, in sadhana bhakti, it's a gradual process, but the shastras point out, you know, sometimes incidences where a person just did this and then he achieved Goloka or Vaikuntha by that one act. So these are all potent activities because they're related to the Supreme Lord. And therefore they're mentioned here as different items. So we have the whole body mentioned like this. Voice, of course, is very important because it's kirtan, basically. Different types of glorification of the Lord. Of which we have, the most important one for us is Nam Kirtan, or Nam Sankirtan. This is what we consider the most important. It's the Kali Yuga Dharma. However, we can also use the voice in other ways. We can use the Kirtan, Guna Kirtan, glorifying the Lord's qualities, or Lila Kirtan, glorifying the Lord's activities, qualities and activities, Lila Kirtan, Guna Kirtan. And as well as that, then we also have recitation of verses, like the prayers of Gajendra, etc., and different prayers of different great devotees. Those can be recited. Those are also considered vocal offerings. So in this way, we have many ways of engaging the voice. Of course, for all of these activities, it's also mentioned by Rupa Goswami that in any case, we also have to involve the mind. To always remember and never forget the Lord. So the mind is also important in all these activities. Ultimately, all these activities are there so the mind will concentrate on the Supreme Lord. So the mind is involved in all of them. So then we have the vocal things, the vocal activities. And then included in this is also japa. This is also under the vocal. It could also be under the mental, but we can put it under the vocal also. There's a distinction between japa and other forms of kirtan, and that is that it's for one's self. And generally it's for one's self. Whereas kirtan is for everyone, and it's public, and it's glorification, so everyone can hear. So japa is not meant for other people to hear. It's for yourself to hear. It also mentions there's three types of japa. That is silent one, or manasik, and then slightly audible, and then very audible. The vachik one is very audible, and the other in-between one is upangsu, which is you can hear. Others don't hear. And then the other one is manasik, and the silent one. Now, in some shastras, they say the best one for mantras is manasik. It's even quoted in Hari Bhakti Vilasa. The best one is manasik. However, that's for mantra. And mantras necessarily are also manasik, because we don't, they're secret mantras, diksha mantras. So you don't tell them to anybody anyway, so it has to be manasik. As far as the holy name, doing japa of the holy name, there's no restriction. So it can be manasik. It can be upangsu, or it can be vachik, it can be loud, it can be anyway. However, Haridas Thakur, he was criticized for chanting loudly. And Kulavecha Sridhar also was criticized for chanting loudly. When he would chant the names of the Lord at night, then everyone would start saying, you're just making this big noise, you know. You shouldn't be chanting loudly. Probably you got a stomach ache and you're just screaming out for pain or something like that because you're hungry, so don't chant so loud. So they would criticize him. And anyway, you shouldn't be chanting aloud. You should chant in your mind. It's the best way to chant. And Haridas Thakur also, they would criticize him because he would chant loudly sometimes, softly sometimes. But then they would challenge. So he simply said that actually it's better to chant loudly the holy name. Because there's no restriction of secrecy anyway. And if I chant loudly, then other living entities get the benefit of hearing. So therefore, by chanting loudly, I can deliver other living entities. So that's better. The more living entities we can deliver, the better. So this is a better service of the Supreme Lord. Therefore, it's more powerful to chant loudly. So that's the defense of chanting loudly. And is more beneficial for everyone. Yeah? So anyway, generally, however, we chant for ourselves, and it's generally audible, at least to ourselves. Kirtan means to glorify the Lord. So when we do Nam-Kirtan, that means like the Hare Krishna mantra, that is a glorification of the Lord by simply taking His name. There's a difference between name and mantra when they use it in Shastra. There's a distinction. Mantra generally refers to the secret mantras, which are not uttered publicly, and that's what you get a diksha. Huh? Other way we use mantras for like Vedic mantra, huh? The such a term is also there, and we say the mantras of Bhagavad Gita, etc. It's a very general way, but when we want to be more particular, then it refers particularly to the secret mantras. Huh? And when we refer to name or nama in contrast to the mantra, that means it's simply the name of the Lord. Huh? So there's several differences. One is that in construction, huh? Names simply mean names of the Supreme Lord. Huh? And they are simply chanted without any other words. Just like Govinda, Achyuta, Madhusudan, Hari, that's all. In Sanskrit, they have different cases. Like we have subject, object, verb, etc. And the noun goes into different cases. So the case for the name is vocative case, calling out. Hare. That's Hari, actually, but it becomes Hare in the vocative case, calling out case, Sambodhana. Huh? And similarly, Radha becomes Radhe. You know, when you call out Radha, it becomes Radhe. So in Vrindavan, they don't call out Radha, Radha, they say Radhe, Radhe. Because that's the correct form for calling out, oh Radha. Huh? So there's always, sometimes it's the same, Krishna is Krishna in both forms. Krishna does something, it's Krishna. And when you say Krishna, we call out, it's also the same form, basically, without an ending on it. Huh? And sometimes it's different. So Hari becomes Hare, and Radha becomes Radhe. And Guru becomes Guru. Oh Guru becomes Guru. Yeah? So there's some, you know, Sanskrit grammar involved. Huh? So anyways, Sambodhana or vocative case, calling out, that's the name. So there's no other words that go with it. There's no verb there at all. Nothing. Whereas the mantra has got the name of the Lord in it as its most powerful component. In other words, the Krishna mantra has the name Krishna in it somewhere, or one of the names of Krishna, like Govind or Gopal or something there. So it'll have a name of the Supreme Lord. Yeah? But it also will have a verb form, and as Namaha or Swaha or something like that on it as well. Which means I pay my respects or my obeisances to Krishna. So then Krishna is in another case. It's called the dative case, like Krishnaya Namaha, Vishnave Namaha, Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. These are in the dative case, unto so-and-so, or to so-and-so. Huh? So it got a different ending on it. So we'll have the Namaha or the Swaha or some other word there. We'll have the name of the Lord in the dative case, and we'll maybe have some other descriptive terms there, and most likely we'll have a bead syllable there. There's a special syllable for each deity, which embodies the essence of the deity. So that is placed in the front, and sometimes in the front and the back of a mantra. So that makes a mantra. That's the components of a mantra. So these are not public, these are private mantras that the guru gives to the disciple, and he chants monastically. So that's the difference, grammatical difference. Practical difference is that those mantras are secret, and only done given through the diksha ceremony by the guru. Whereas the holy name is not secret, doesn't have to be given by the guru, and you can still chant it. And doesn't require such high qualifications, the Yuga Dharma, and everyone can do it, provided they got faith. So there's a difference there. So nam is one thing with a different form and different areas of qualification, or different standard of qualification, and then we have the mantra, which is a different standard. So we cannot chant mantras, these diksha mantras in kirtan, you cannot do that. But name you can. Technically, no. It would refer to the other mantras. Yeah, we often use it, but actually it should be the other mantras. Now, of course, the holy name also is, we can say, in one sense, needs a person to give it. Just like because the other verse is that Harikatha, Putam Harikatha, if it comes from Avaishnava, from the mouth of an non-Vaishnava, then even Harikatha, not just the name or mantra, but anything about the Supreme Lord, becomes poisoned coming from a non-Vaishnava. Therefore, it has to come from a Vaishnava, one who believes, and a Vaishnava should be in a Sampradaya. So any topic should come from a Sampradaya, whether it's hearing Bhagavatam, or the name, or the mantra. It all has to come from a Sampradaya. And a guru should be in a Sampradaya. Has to come from a guru, it should be in a Sampradaya. So even the speaking has to come from somewhere. It cannot be just unauthoritative. It has to be from someone of faith, and that person would have an authority and a Sampradaya. So technically, even the holy name, yes, it would apply to the holy name. Though I think in that case particularly, it means mantra there refers to the other mantra. But, also refers to the holy name in a more broad sense, of course, because you don't need diksha for it, but still, should come from a person who has devotion and faith. Then it has potency. If it comes from a non-believer, it's very little. If we say it's namavasa at best, if it's from an aparadi, then it's no value at all. Well, I haven't heard any explicit thing about that, but from the point of view of logic, obviously, the more advanced a devotee is, then the more potency anything has that he does, whether it is speaking about the Lord or chanting or whatever. And the more powerful influence it has, obviously, because his shakti is in there. And the less advanced one is, obviously, the less it is like what we call it, the transparent via media. The more transparent you are, then the more Krishna shakti comes through. And the more impurities you got, then the less comes through. Just like the clouds in the sky, if it's full of clouds, then the sunlight doesn't come through so well. If there's little clouds, some comes through. If there's no clouds, then a lot comes through. A lot of sunlight comes through. So the potency comes through according to the parent, purity or impurity. So that's explained in terms of namabhas. Namabhas means cloudy. So the effect of the holy name is not coming through 100%. And sudana means it's coming through clearly. So there's more potency there, obviously. The other point, of course, is that on our part, also reception on our part, it could be the holy name, but if we're all covered over, then it won't penetrate also. And the more open we are, and the more pure we are, the more it can affect us. So it's like both sides. There should be qualification on both sides. Obviously, Sankirtan means in a group, or together. And the Yuga Dharma is together. So individually we have a little bit of potency, and together there's more potency. This is also a common factor even in the material world. When people get together then with the same idea, it becomes more powerful. Materially speaking, it's called synergy. So, spiritually speaking, the same thing. That's why we have associations. They come together, then there's more. Even people have a little bit. When they come together, it creates the total effect is more than the sum of the parts. Somehow it becomes more. Yeah? Like that. So in the material world, it's also there, spiritually speaking. So, if people are together, even if they're not 100% pure, and they come together, then that total effect is very, very powerful. Okay, so we just talked a little about nam and mantra there. Voice. So particularly for Kali Yuga, the voice is very important. Therefore, the kirtan, the sankirtan and the nam sankirtan is very important. But the others are also items which are for purification, such as chanting verses from Bhagavatam. or Leela Kirtans, etc. That taste, obviously Prasadam and Charanamrita, those are the two significant items there. Smelling the incense or the flowers. Touch, there it mentions touching the lotus feet of the Lord. If one is qualified, that means usually the pujaris, they can do that, touch the feet of the Lord. Other people can't. So if one wants to engage in that, then one would have to take the Pancharatra Diksha to do that one. As I said, the smell one also is related to deities. The taste one is somewhat related to deities also. Sight is obvious. Seeing the deity. Seeing the worship of the deity in the form of arti. Or otherwise, seeing the worship of it, if one is qualified, and to go into the pujari room and see the worship itself. And to see festivals, and like Jamasmi, etc. So these are all to do with the sight. Hearing, obviously, is important. Particularly, not all, hearing Shastra, that's important. More important than that is to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. This is always mentioned by the in here, as well as other places in the Gaudiya literature, hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam. Why? Because this is considered the highest pramana by us. Lord Chaitanya quoted from that profusely. You see in Chaitanya Charitamrita, most of the quotes are from Srimad Bhagavatam. He's not quoting from Vedas and Vedanta Sutra. Maybe once in a while he does, but mainly it's Bhagavatam he's quoting from. So Jiva Goswami has pointed out in Tattva Sandarbha that actually this is the highest proof. And therefore, if we simply rely on this, we can get everything from it. We don't need the other works at all. This brings out the conclusion of everything. So if we study this and know this work, then this is the best. The other point, of course, is not only is it give the conclusion, philosophical conclusion of everything, and point out the highest path of Uttama Bhakti, but it also points out the highest tattva, that is Krishna. That's the highest tattva. And then expands on that in the 10th canto by describing his pastimes. So therefore it points out Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam as the highest form. So particularly Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we concentrate on hearing Srimad Bhagavatam because in this way we get a taste for Krishna, develop a taste for Krishna. So hearing is considered very important. In fact, it's considered the first process. Even though we say chanting is the most important, you can't chant unless you hear. So you hear the holy name, you hear the teachings. Then you can chant purely and properly without offense. So hearing is a very, very important process. And to hear, what is the qualification for hearing? Submissiveness. Pranipat. Surrender. Pranipat. Humility and surrender. We see that we have a daily program. We go to Mangalarti, and then have Tulsi Puja, and Dujapa, and Guru Puja, and class, etc. So this is involving all of these items here. We're seeing the deity, chanting his name, hearing, and even though we may not do direct deity worship, we're also participating by seeing the worship of the Lord. So we're getting all these important activities, and we're associating with devotees also. And so in this way, we're getting the important angas. Five important angas are there, so we're getting these in our morning program. Why in the morning? That is because, of course, morning is considered more spiritual, as more conducive for spiritual life. It's easier to practice in the morning. Also, there is a factor of sleep. Sleep is tamogun. And when you sleep, your mind also is not under control. So you can have so many dreams and whatever coming out in your mind at this time. Right? So, and when you wake up, therefore you're in a state of impurity. So the first thing you have to do is purify yourself in the morning. So we have different ways of doing that. One is, when you get up, you're supposed to say the name of the Lord. Or say, chant some verses. You know, this is what Hari Bhaktivilas asks. Beginning, get up, then you chant verses. Then you pay your respects, and to Achyavan pay your respects. Then you go out and take your bath. So just to clear up the mind, you have to say the name of the Lord and think of the Lord and do all these prayers, etc. Then you take your bath. So physically, you purify yourself. But that physical bath, along with that physical bath, there's something else also, and that is the manasic bath. Manasic snan, that's also very important. So along with the physical bath, you take a mental bath. So this is one step above the varnashramic bath, where you just purify the body with water. Manasic means using the mind. In Hari Bhakti Vilas, he mentions a very interesting procedure for carrying out the manasic bath. And that is, you meditate on the causal ocean and the water of the causal ocean touching the feet of the Supreme Lord, streaming down from his feet, coming into the material world through the hole that Vamana cracked up, and coming down, the lotus water, lotus foot water of the Lord coming down and falling in your head and going all over your body and purifying it. So this is a spiritual bath. Just like a physical bath is there, we pour the water on us, then we get the mental bath, and we get the spiritual water pouring over our body from the lotus feet of the Lord. So in this way, we can not only purify physically, but mentally and spiritually also. So this also helps us on a subtle level, let's say, to purify the mind and get rid of all of the dreams and desires and everything from the night. We have to engage the senses, because we wake up and then the senses start beginning active. They start getting active. So we have to purify the body and drive out all the bad tamasic influences of night. And then we got to concentrate the senses so they don't wander. So therefore, that's why we engage the eyes in seeing the form of the Lord rather than anything else. And hearing the name of the Lord rather than anything else. So this way we kind of stuff our senses spiritually. So that nothing else can get in, and that way it's an automatic sort of sense control. Is that manasik snan? I don't know. I don't know what's there.
Well, what you were talking about was from the
Karna ocean. Yeah. I guess that's the Ganga also, isn't it? Yeah. I guess it's equivalent. This, of course, is not the only manasik snan there is, but this is the one given in the Hari Bhakti Vilas, you know. But there's obviously more ways you can do it. simply thinking of the purifying effect of the Supreme Lord, and you can purify by chanting his name, and that's also manasik, we can say. This is just a graphic way of taking a bath. So in this way, we start engaging the senses, and related to the Lord with the eyes and the ears, etc., and tongue and voice, all this. So this makes it all spiritual from the first part of the morning. So that way, throughout the day, generally, there's less possibility of material things creeping in. So it's arranged rather, we can say, scientifically and precisely to, you know, keep us Krishna conscious. There's other items relating to mind, etc. Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita, he also goes over these different items and classifies them generally the same. Then he gets to mind, and then he goes to soul. And then he goes to, I think, time and place, and matter, and then time and place, and then society. So mind, of course, deals with meditation, remembrance, smarana, and dhyana, meditation, he puts under mind. Smarana is, let's say, a less intense level, and dhyana or meditation is a more intense level, fuller concentration. In smarana, one will remember the name of the Lord. Chanting japa also is considered smarana. But dhyana refers, you could chant the holy name also, but there is a more precise meditation on the form, qualities, and activities of the Lord in meditation. It will be more and more specific and precise in meditation. In other words, more concentration in meditation or dhyana. In relation to this, Rupa Goswami recites the story here. He gives the whole story of the Brahmana and how the Brahmana was feeling a little bit sad because he didn't have any money and he couldn't worship the Lord properly. And then he heard one devotee giving a lecture and saying that one can get the same effects by worshipping in the mind, manasik puja. And it's good, if not better. And of course in Hari Bhakti Vilas, actually it says there that the manasik puja is superior to the external worship of the Lord. So this Brahmana was very happy when he heard this because he didn't have any finances to do the external worship properly. So therefore he decided, I will do the internal worship. So therefore began meditating on worshipping the Supreme Lord. And in meditation, he was not restricted by material considerations. Therefore, he could bring the most expensive, valuable, precious utensils made out of gold and jewels, and with golden water pots and golden art utensils, etc. And he could worship the Lord, dress the Lord in jewels and silk, etc., and crown. So he could do everything very, very wonderfully like this. And he was getting great relish doing this. And then he came to the point where he went on in the worship, and then he has to make an offering to the Lord. That is Naivedya, which is almost the last offering, the 16th Upachar, 15th and 16th Upachar, offering some food to the Lord. And so therefore he decided, I will make some pious, sweet rice. So he cooked the sweet rice in his meditation and cooked it down and then put in the sugar like that. And then he thought, well, it must be too hot. I can't offer the Lord when it's too hot, you know, because he'll burn his, you know, fingers or his lips in it. So therefore he stuck his finger in it. When he stuck his finger in it, it got burned. And ouch! And then he woke up. He woke up out of his trance and he had a burned finger. Actual burned finger. Even though he had done it in his meditation. Touched in the meditation. So of course, due to his devotion, and Lakshmi was very moved by that. And she took him to the spiritual world. So that story is there to point out the power of meditation. Or in our case, we don't simply meditate, but we actually... Meditation is also there in the puja vidhi, and the steps. Meditation is first on the Lord and His form. Then, once you've got the Lord fixed in your mind with the proper form and qualities, then you worship Him. That's called manasik puja. So this Brahmana had gone to the stage of manasik puja where he was serving the Lord in his spiritual body. And it became actual for him. And therefore the Lord responded, and he actually burned his finger and the Lord responded and took him to the spiritual world. So therefore that story is there to glorify the potency of meditation and manasik puja. And it's, the Lord is there, even in the mind. We have different forms of murti. One is the external murti made out of jewel or wood or metal. Or sand. The other one is in the mind. So the mental one is through meditation. We worship that Lord through meditation and manasik puja. So that's a mental use of the mind. So anyway, these mental ones are there. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he classifies others as soul. He actually puts the dasya also. And saranapati in the mental thing, that is surrender, and dasya, servitude, in this mental thing. Because it's actually not dasya, because dasya actually is a rasa,
And that will, you'll only start getting in bhava and prema. So we cannot practice dasya rasa now, or even sakya rasa. These we cannot actually practice in vaidhi bhakti, though they're mentioned here, and in the angas of the nine types of devotional service, you have dasya, sakyam, amanivedana. So these are all actually very high processes to follow. Yet they're mentioned as, you know, angas of vaidhi bhakti also. Yeah? So in vaidhi bhakti, this dasya doesn't mean that dasya, and the sakya doesn't mean that sakya that we see with, you know, Arjuna and others. This is like an aspiration for that, and it's more like an attitude. So we have an attitude of service to the Supreme Lord, and this is a dasya that we can practice on this stage. And to expect friendship from the Lord, that's the sakya also. So anyway, Bhaktivinoda Thakur classifies the dasya as a mental attitude, and similarly that surrender. We cannot do it perfectly at this stage, but the idea that we want to surrender and everything belongs to the Lord, He's my protector, we have this attitude even in sadhana bhakti. And then under soul he puts some other items like offering everything to the Lord and giving up everything for the sake of the Lord. That was in our first group of angas, to give up one's own enjoyment for the service of the Lord, like that. And he puts sakya also on this level of regarding the Lord as a friend, because it has to do with evoking the emotions of the soul in relation and giving up material things. So he put soul in a separate category there. One other item is to offer the best items to the Lord, or offer one's dear item to the Lord. One item which is dear to you, you offer that to the Lord. So in this way, all of the different senses are covered, and the mind is covered. And then, of course, Bhaktivinoda says the soul also is covered here. And then time and place, of course, he says things like living in the holy dhams is like place. Time is to celebrate festivals and things like that. Social devotee association, plus festivals, participating in festivals, when you come together in groups. It says social interaction. After mentioning all these things, then Rupa Goswami says actually five are the most potent. Because by practicing one of these, any one of these, very quickly, one can go through the process of sadhana and attain bhava. So therefore they're powerful items. Five powerful items. That is, hearing, bhagavatam. Chanting names of the Lord, worship of the deity, the archana process, the form of Krishna particularly, living in the holy dham, association with the devotees of the Lord. And these are very, very important, very, very powerful items. And he actually gives, Rupa Goswami composes his own verses, to glorify each of these items. Some of them are quite interesting. The ones concerning the Bhagavatam and the one concerning deity worship are very interesting. But actually the deity worship one, he doesn't really mention the deity there at all, but he mentions the form of the Supreme Lord on the bank of the Jamuna at Keshigat. Not actually the actual Govinda with a smile on his face and his lips and a peacock feather in his hair and a flute in his mouth, and he's illuminated by the moon, and he describes him like that. And then he says that if you want to maintain your enjoyment of material life with family and friends, etc., then don't go near this. Don't go to Keshigat. Don't look at this person at all. So in other words, by negation, he's pointing out the glory of the Lord. So if you don't want to give up your family and your attachments, etc., then don't look upon this form of Govinda. Because when you do, then you lose interest in everything. And only have interest in the Supreme Lord. And of course in the stage of bhava, this is exactly what happens. There's great attachment to the Lord, no attraction to the material things, the material enjoyments. One's virakti, completely detached from material things, and completely attached to hearing about the Lord, glorifying the Lord, etc. So, by seeing the form of the Lord, that is quickly invoked. So therefore he glorifies this form. So the deity is non-different from the Supreme Lord, so therefore that's an easy way for us to see the Lord. And we see the great devotees, in spite of the fact that we do have Nam Sankirtan as Yuga Dharma, they all had deities. All the associates in Vrindavan had deities, and the Goswamis, and here even in the Navadvipa and Gauramandala, they all had temples and they all had deities. They all established deities. So though we say that the Nam is, Yuga Dharma, still the form of the Lord is very, very important also. So all the acharyas had their deities and were worshipping deities also. So therefore, seeing the form of the Lord is very, very powerful. You know, seeing the form and then worshipping the Lord is a very powerful process to bring us to realization, actual realization of the Lord. In the same way, the same mood, he also glorifies the Bhagavatam by criticism. You're a fool because you've listened to the words of the Bhagavatam, and now that you've listened to the words of the Bhagavatam, you're going to give up your interest in all the things that other people of the world run after. So therefore you're very unfortunate. So in this way he glorifies these processes, particular processes. He also mentions that you can practice one or many, it doesn't really matter. They're all powerful processes. And later he gives examples for each one, but these five particularly are very powerful, and therefore generally we do all of these. Except perhaps living in the holy Dham. Now that we cannot literally do, and the Goswamis also recognize that not everyone can live in the holy Dham, but that's the aspiration, and therefore we see that all the Goswamis went there to live in the holy Dham. So that's generally considered an aspiration. However, exceptions are made. It says if you cannot go to the holy Dham, there are several things you can do. The one they mentioned is if you cannot go to the holy Dham, then you can meditate on the holy Dham. And that's also good. So then there's also many verses like that for meditating on the Dham. Acharyas have written many verses describing the holy Dham of Raja and Navadvip. So you can meditate on the holy Dham, and that's as good as being there also. Another thing, of course, we can visit periodically, and that's what Prabhupada has mentioned, that though we cannot live there, at least we can go on pilgrimage. So therefore he arranged for the Mayapur Vrindavan festivals, and we can go to these festivals, and that way we can get association with the Dham for a short period of time. Okay. Sometimes, some of these verses, Rupa Goswami mentions the Angas, then he goes to each Anga and quotes a verse or several verses for each one. In some of the verses, actually, they'll glorify the Anga, but then they'll say you get material results, like going to Svarga or getting this or that. So the whole point is to glorify the Anga, but not to take the material benefits there, because he's just taking it from different Puranas, which may be for normal people in the material world. So we're not interested in those material results. We're not interested in bhakti or mukti. So we're not interested in going to Svarga or getting liberation, though these things are mentioned in relation in these different verses that are quoted. So that we ignore, and this is for lesser people. We're only interested in serving the Supreme Lord. So we don't take those results as final results. Same in the Hari Bhakti Vilas. They'll quote many verses, and sometimes they will give material results also, but we have to understand that's only there to show that these are Angas and they're approved, but we don't take those same results. Any question there? Oh, we're over time. Anyway, take a little break. There is a rule that generally you pay your obeisances when the person can respond. So therefore, when a person is eating, bathing, sleeping, you don't pay your respects because they can't do anything. The mouth is full of food, or they're sleeping, or whatever, they can't reply. And it's the etiquette that someone should respond to the obeisance or whatever. So if they can't do that, then it's not considered proper. So generally you don't. That's the same technically. That's why they generally close the temple completely in like normal temples. They close so you can't come in anyway and during sleeping hours. Yeah, people are wandering, going, like, technically I think maybe you shouldn't do that. Yeah, you're dressing, yeah. So that they basically the best time is during darshan or after darshan, when their deities are open also. Okay, I'll take a break here. That's the break.
Oh, I see.
But recently, when I brought the Prabhupada to Temple One Matiji,
yes.
She was telling us that this Matiji should not marry. So she said, oh, how old is your husband? And she said, no, I'm not married. So she said, no, you're having a bindi. So then he said, oh, we wear bindi all the time. So then she said, Prabhupada said, we don't wear bindi before we get married.
Okay.
So then he said, oh, but we always wore bindi from the time we were
young.
Then she was explaining that it's something material, and it's like Krishna's lotus.
Oh, bindi. Well, I haven't seen any Shastric thing on the bindi one way or the other. I don't know what the usage is, actually. Radharani has a bindi. Oh, yeah, she is married too, but not to Krishna. Yeah. Should have tilak though. I don't know, it doesn't say anything about that. Let's see. Does Lakshmi have a bindi? She also has a tilak in it. In Sanskrit, she has a thing like that. It looks like a tilak. What is that? In the deities? Do they have this thing like this? It's like a tilak, so it's a different shape.
No, that's in this context, they say. If you are unmanaged, then you don't
use it. Yes.
But in Indian tradition, they do.
They do.
Yeah.
The girls also wear it.
Yeah.
Everywhere, north and south?
Yeah.
They all wear it. Yeah. Oh, I've seen. So, Prabhupada, anyone know? Prabhupada say anything?
Prabhupada's family is Muslim.
Oh, I see. Did Prabhupada say anything? I don't know.
Well, his manager was saying in Bombay, there's a Mataji, she spoke about what Prabhupada said. But then when you hear from others,
it's
like
other
seniors
that
your
problems,
they say, no, you have to wear
suits. So it's not a marriage thing at all. Oh, I don't know what the origin is, because we don't hear mentioned in Hari Vakivilatra anywhere either. So. I don't know. Oh, I see. Well, I've heard this, but this is nothing authoritative, that it takes the attention away from lust and makes them spiritual, I suppose. The people looking also, they'll concentrate not on the face, but they'll see the spot, so they won't look at your face in lust. The other point, of course, is obviously, it's like the tilak. But if you touch the forehead, if you said a mantra, then it'd be very good, because then you can concentrate on the Supreme Lord. Yes, sir.
Is our tilak on Vishnu's foot inside?
Huh?
Our tilak on Buddha Vajna, is it Vishnu's foot
inside? Well, there's different versions of this tilak. There's all sorts of ideas about it. One is the foot of Vishnu, the other is Brahma Vishnu Shiva, Bodh Brahma Vishnu Shiva, etc. So there's no one conclusion there, even in the Hari Bhaktivalasa, it just quotes different things, it doesn't give any conclusion on what it actually is, you know. And similarly, now there's some pradayas like that, but generally they seem to indicate, it also indicates the lotus foot of the Lord. And particularly Sri Vaishnava, they make the tilak in the form of two feet, actually, like that. Yeah. It's a term of 2 feet, and they got little feet with the toes on it, even if they draw it like that. Like 2 feet are sitting there like that. Then there's another question, why Radharani hasn't got tilak?
Oh, because she's not putting
feet on her. And Krishna's got tilak, he's got his own feet on his head. Yeah. But yeah, that tilak may not mean this tilak though, because tilak can mean any marks on the face or something like that. Yeah. In one place it mentions that she has tilak, but I think it's in the form of some, like a flower or something like that.
Like a moon, you know?
Huh?
Sometimes like moon, you know, it's tilak.
Yeah. Yeah, also that's why tilak could just mean bindi or could mean anything else. It doesn't mean particularly just a Vaishnava thing. Okay. So any more questions on angas? Angas? No questions. So Rupa Goswami then says what are not angas. He says Varnashram is not an anga of bhakti. In other words, being a brahmachari or a sannyasi or a grihasta is not really an anga of bhakti, he says. In other words, by doing the practicing those things, it does not give you attachment to the Lord, and it doesn't raise you up to bhava in itself. It doesn't do that. Just like bathing does not induce bhava in itself, or being vegetarian does not bring you from faith to bhava either. These other items do. Offering respects, chanting, hearing, and that can raise you up. Your soul becomes more and more attracted to the Lord. Just bathing won't do that. They're not directly related to the Lord. That is why Bhaktivinoda puts these other things as gona vidhi. Parts of our nashram that we do follow,
Because it's necessary for the body and for society, but they don't directly induce bhakti, so therefore they're called secondary items. So the primary items, or the mukhya vidhi, are those which will, by themselves, give you advancement in your Krishna consciousness and develop the soul, love of God. So varnashram in itself is not an anga of bhakti. It may be favorable, unfavorable, whatever, but it's not an anga as such. Those that don't have bhakti, they can follow that in order to purify themselves with the gunas. And jnana and vairagya are not angas. Jnana and vairagya are very much praised in other shastras, not bhakti shastras, but other shastras, because we want detachment from the world and we want knowledge in order to get liberation. For liberation, we need jnana and vairagya. So those are, we can say, practices or angas of mukti, for getting mukti, jnana and vairagya angas. But they're not angas for bhakti. And the reason is that they're not favorable for increasing attachment to the Lord. Rather, they detach you from it, make you indifferent to the Lord. So that's what it means by saying it dries up the heart. The heart should melt for Krishna. That is what happens in bhava. The heart begins to melt, and prema is completely melted. In other words, one's attraction for the Lord is very, very strong. But with these things, practicing does the opposite. One becomes more and more disinterested in the Lord. So jnana does this because, one, of course, the philosophy is such that it negates its qualities, its form, and its activities. We don't want the Lord to be a person, so automatically there's... Then it becomes aparad. So you can't have any taste for the Lord at all. An attraction for the Lord, the very nature of jnana as such. The other point, of course, is it relies heavily on logic and intellect. But bhakti is developed not by tarka and logic, but by taste. And vairagya is a conscious effort to detach oneself, renunciation, detachment, vratas, doing vratas, etc., which the jnanis and the yogis do, to become indifferent to the material world. Now, to a certain extent, that is favorable for devotional service, because if we're too attached, we cannot practice. Therefore, it says, na'ati sakta, one should not be too attached to the material thing. But it also says, not too detached either. So if we're too detached, then we're liable to become impersonalistic. So the vairagya, practicing a lot of vairagya, renunciation, can lead to impersonalism also. So therefore, not generally considered favorable. However, Rupa Goswami says that these may be slightly favorable in the beginning stages of bhakti. In other words, detachment is favorable because we shouldn't be too much engrossed in the sense. And jnana, to some extent, because we have to use our mind to some extent also, but more than a little, this is not very favorable. And certainly in later stages, they become insignificant. And therefore, in the Bhagavatam it says that automatically jnana and vairagya manifest for one who's practicing devotional service. And they're not angas, but they will manifest. We will get detached from the material world automatically by attachment to Krishna. We'll develop knowledge, not knowledge of Brahman, but knowledge of Krishna. Naturally develop with the practice of bhakti. So we don't have to, they're not separate angas. And if they're practiced as prominent angas, then they'll lead one away from the Lord. You may get mukti, you won't get the Lord.
Jnana and the cultivation of the difference between the soul and the body is
not
Prabhupada preached heavily on that.
The beginning stages, I guess we can call that. And like a beginning of Bhagavad Gita. You're not the soul, you're not the body or the soul. That, of course, is not directly getting into the jnana level of, impersonalism and everything like that. It's just differentiating the soul from the body. So that much, of course, we have in Sambandha Jnana also. Body is matter, soul, and Supreme Lord. So we can take that as part of Sambandha Jnana, actually. not so much as the practice of jnana, where one studies the Vedanta Sutras and, you know, logically tries to argue on basis of that and negate everything, you know, negate material world, etc. So, as I said before, jnana is jnana, karma, ajnana, avartama. It's not covered by jnana and karma, but to some extent we need knowledge. And some knowledge is favorable for our devotional development, like Bhagavad Gita, Sambandha Gita, that is favorable. So that much we accept. This Gita particularly refers to the impersonalistic Gita and heavy use of logic and meditation of Vedanta Sutras, etc.
Why is this chapter linked to devotion for devotional qualifications?
Oh, I think it's the opposite. Non-qualifications. Things which don't qualify you for practice. Therefore, varnashrama is not a quality, jnana and vairagya is not a qualification, and wealth is not a qualification, number of disciples is not a qualification. These don't qualify, and they're not angas of bhakti. Okay? They're neither qualifications nor angas. So we don't, this was mentioned before, varnashrama was mentioned before, it's not a qualification, and it's also not an anga. It's not an essential practice which directly develops bhakti. And jnana and vairagya, similarly, are not angas of bhakti that give you devotion, rather they deplete your devotion.
In other words, this chapter talks about like these things don't qualify.
Yeah, are there not angas also? Yeah. Well, what is the title actually?
Devotional qualification.
Oh, I see. I don't know why. Maybe it's mistitled. I don't know. But if you see in the original, actually, it says these are not, this is under the angas, because we're talking about angas, yes? And then it says these are not angas, and then it mentions this. Yeah. So, jnana and vairagya are not angas, and neither is wealth and disciples, taking disciples. These are not angas of bhakti. Our goal is not to get wealth, nor to get disciples. So previously was mentioned in the second set of 10, to acquire many disciples, that's considered a do not take many disciples. So that in itself is not an anga of bhakti also. On the other hand, Sankirtan is an anga, preaching is an anga, so out of that obviously there will be disciples also, so, but this is not like a primary thing, that's not our goal, simply to make disciples or to get wealth or whatever. They may appear in the performance of devotional service, but they're not goals in themselves or activities in themselves of devotional service. And even taking, developing good qualities is not an anga bhakti, even though we see that subhada, our development of good qualities, manifests through bhakti, but it's not a separate anga or practice that we do as part of our bhakti. Okay? But other people do this as part of their sadhana, for instance, in yoga. And they do yama and niyama, and there they're cultivating good qualities and whatever, like that. So this is like an anga for them to develop these qualities. Similarly, in jnana, the good conduct is stressed, and they have to practice these things. Not becoming angry, etc. Morality, moral principles. Cultivating moral principles. That doesn't mean we're immoral, but they naturally develop. Now we have a limitation. Also, we have four regulative principles. This is also moral in one sense. So this is a lower limit. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. Okay? And then we practice bhakti. And through the process of bhakti, the qualities naturally develop in their pure form. Okay? So it's not that we're immoral. We do set a limit on things which will make it unfavorable, that immorality. But at the same time, we want it to naturally develop as byproduct of the development of the soul's attraction to Krishna. Okay?
When we look at Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's teachings and his moves, the Tamasa Dharadas, like one feeling great unhappiness, how would his people be delivered to me personally when preaching in South India? I'm a little boy. Prabhupada often accesses all of these aspects of Mahaprabhu's mood and emphasizes preaching. Distributing books and doing sankirtan and spreading the movement. But it doesn't seem like that mood is kind of
The preaching and everything like that. We see that the Lord's mood is Lord Chaitanya's mood is Audarja, very generous and munificent, and therefore he wants to save all the souls of the material world. In fact, he's considered the most merciful, and he saves the most fallen, who otherwise Krishna even wouldn't accept them because they're too fallen. But he wants to deliver even the most fallen, like Jagai Madai and Aparadis. As far as the nectar of devotion is concerned, the only way that comes out, we will say, is that ultimately everything depends on the mercy of the devotee. Yeah? And that becomes very prominent. Of course, we see even in the very beginning. Yeah? It doesn't, of course, emphasize the fact that once you go out and preach and whatever like that, it's not so emphatic. But nevertheless, we see that the main cause of bhakti and its development is the mercy of the devotee. So it's kind of implicit behind it all that the mercy is important. If we want to get bhakti, and bhakti is the most important thing for everybody, it's the goal of everybody's life, and one can only get that through mercy. So then the devotees have to give the mercy out. So it's implicit, but it's not stated directly. Yeah. They're natural results. Like even Bhagavatam says that by practicing a surrender to Vasudeva Krishna, then naturally, very quickly, one will develop Jnana Vairagya. They're not the goals, nor are they the practice. So they naturally develop. We can say, yeah. Detachment is one of the symptoms of bhava, is to be detached from material energy, material things. Huh? Jnana, of course, we don't want the negative jnana, but bhukti and mukti are naturally begging from the devotee to give me some service. So one on bhava level has surpassed mukti already. So he surpassed the goal of jnana by having a darshan of Krishna, and then he doesn't even consider jnana important anymore, mukti important. So he's already achieved beyond jnana and vairagya by the stage of bhava. Vairagya is important in the sense that we have yukta vairagya. And that's the next point that Rupa Goswami says. We don't want vairagya, but what we do practice is yukta vairagya. That means we understand that everything in the material world can be useful in relation to Krishna. So we don't reject things in the material world and artificially detach ourselves from them. As much as possible, we try to engage everything for the service of Krishna. That's yukta vairagya. So this is similar to Lord Chaitanya when he took sannyas. Sannyas also means, nyasa means to give up. Sannyas means to give everything up. You become detached from everything. That is sannyas. But when he took sannyas, then he quoted from Bhagavatam. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam about the Avanti Brahmana. Avanti Brahmana was a nice Brahmana, and then he got kicked out of his house by his relatives and his family because he was too poor, and they took all of his money, etc., whatever he had, and they kicked him out. Then he became a Tridandi sannyasi. Yeah? So he quoted one verse of that Avanti Brahmana, in which it says that real renunciation is to give everything to the Lord. Yeah? So that was Lord Chaitanya's sannyas. It wasn't giving up anything, but giving everything to Krishna. So that is similar to this yukta vairagya. Yeah? So vairagya, in the sense, it was not for ourselves, but it's not simply not for ourselves. It is for Krishna. That way, it's yukta. It's connected to Krishna. We connect everything to Krishna, and automatically it's not for ourselves. Whereas the Mayavadis and others, yeah, not for myself. Well, not for anybody else also. It's not for myself. But yukta vairagya is not for myself, but for Krishna. So yukta means to join together. So joining to Krishna, giving everything to Krishna instead of to just rejecting it. In fact, by joining everything to Krishna automatically, we renounce it. We're doing everything, offering everything to Krishna with the intention of pleasing Him and nothing for ourselves. So
by giving things to Krishna automatically, we don't claim anything for ourselves. So it's automatically Vairagya. It all belongs to the Lord anyway. We are thieves when we take it for ourselves anyway. Automatically it's the Lord's. And of course, the Lord actually doesn't need it because it's His already. So what is important there is our recognizing that He is the Lord of it, and we're giving it to Him as a sign of affection to Him, but actually doesn't need it also. But our act of giving something to the Lord, that the Lord appreciates. The bhakti He appreciates. So in giving everything up and offering it to the Lord, actually the important element there again is the devotion. That's what the Lord accepts. So Phalgu Vairagya means that one gives up objects, attachment to objects, with the idea of even getting liberated from the material world. That, and that's all. But that's called Phalgu or false Vairagya. To his house. So in other words, before we had that verse, say adhikara esmin, that one should act according to qualification and not go beyond qualification. So that's an example of that. You're not qualified yet to leave the house. So you go back and you practice within the house of becoming more and more detached. When you're completely detached, fine, then you leave. When you're qualified, then you can leave. So after many, many attempts, then finally the Lord did accept him. But his first instruction, go back into the house and you stay there, but don't become pramatta. Don't become overcome by the material attractions. When you've learned how to do that, then you can join me. No.
Quite a lot of the Bhagavad Gita could be in support of Jnana and Vairagya.
Bhagavad Gita, yeah. Well, Bhagavad Gita is everything. Bhagavad Gita actually is like a summary of the whole Vedic tradition. So we have karma in there, karma kanda, everything. You worship the devatas and you can get all your desires fulfilled. live happily in this material world. It's got the jnana in there in the form of Brahma Nirvana, etc. A whole chapter on Brahma Nirvana. It's got yoga in there in chapter 6, sitting down on your skin and meditating, all this. So it's got a mixture of everything. But after all that, his final conclusion is, become my devotee. And so he goes through all the different processes, Vedic processes that people are familiar with, and then finally he says that the best process is, be my devotee. And then in the last 6 chapters, in the middle 6 chapters, you won't find any of this. The last 6 chapters, then it'll appear to some degree. Again. But then again, finally he concludes, surrender unto me, etc. So these are like, that's why we have to take not the verses in themselves, but according to context of chapter, and then of the whole work. And that way we can come to the real significance of the statements. Otherwise, you can quote anything and come up with any conclusion. That's called half a chicken logic. Oh yeah, I just got some very impersonal slokas in there somewhere in the 11th chapter, or sometimes some very surprisingly impersonal statements there. But, people have seriously taken those out, so therefore the Srimad Bhagavatam is an impersonal literature, actually. On those few slokas, which is very misleading, because actually we see the rest of it is chanting, hearing, worshipping the Lord, etc. Very, very heavy. So the number of verses about hearing and chanting and remembering the Lord is so much more. And when you get a few verses like that, people pull them out and say, therefore this is impersonal work, actually. But that's misreading, misinterpreting the whole text. In bhakti, no. In mukti, yes. Because for bhakti, actually, it's unfavorable. In the 11th canto. Yeah. Well, the explanation is that he was appealing to some of the jnanis in the audience, and therefore he mentioned that in some sections. Yeah. But just like in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita, a lot of it is karma. Karmakanda, actually. That first part especially, where he says, you know, fulfill all your desires by worshipping devatas. And then he says the directly opposite of that in chapter 9. Don't worship the devatas, it's foolish. Direct contradiction is there. Yeah? But we have to see the, you know, progression and final thing. So though in a few chapters in the 11th canto, he may tend towards impersonal, then we see the rest of it is, you know, completely devotional. So therefore we take it as something incidental, not as the main element.
Okay, so Rupa Goswami concludes the Anga section by saying, just giving examples of people who practice one Anga and they got perfection. So he gives examples for each one. Sukadev for Kirtan, Parikshit for hearing process, Prahlad for Smaranam. He always remembered the Lord. Yeah? And when he was thrown off the cliff, he remembered Vishnu. When he was getting tortured and whatever by the Rakshasa, he remembered Vishnu. So always remembering the Lord. Akura for Vandanam. Because Akura was always, when he was going to from Mathura to Vrindavan, and then he was meditating on the Lord and thinking of his lotus feet and offering prayers. And then when he saw the feet, then he did his Vandanas on the ground, lotus feet of the Lord. So this is the perfection of life. Yeah? To get a chance to see these imprints of the foot of feet of Krishna. Padasevan as Lakshmi, Dasyam Hanuman, Sakyam Arjuna, Archanam Prithu, and Atmanivedanam Bali. But as I mentioned, the Sakya, the Dasya, and Atmanivedana, actually as sadhana, are very rare in its pure form. So like reflections, we can say, and his attitude of having a servitude to the Lord, or full surrender, can be practiced, but it's not really the full thing in sadhana bhakti. And Ambarish did all on this, many, many angas of devotional service. Generally, we concentrate on the five angas, the five ones, five important ones. Yeah. Also, I've wondered about that. I've not seen any commentary on that, how he was for Archana particularly, because it came in another yuga, obviously, not in a Dwarpa yuga, with Archana as the main process. But there probably is some reference, you know, some verse somewhere that said he was perfect Archana. So we covered the now Vaidhi Bhakti, which was according to the force of, or the authority of rules. So all of these items here, angas, are mentioned in the Shastra, and therefore Rupa Goswami is very careful to quote Shastra for each one of them. And particularly how to practice also is mentioned, not just the anga, but how to practice, particularly for deity worship. So that's a whole other, that anga is quite elaborate and has many sub-angas in it also, some of which are mentioned here in Next Year Devotion. So there's particular rules and regulations, and we follow Shastra. So if we want to worship the Lord through Archana, we follow Pancharatrika Vidhi, the rules of Pancharatra Shastra for that, for the worship of the Lord. Yeah? And then I have a whole other set of rules for deity worship. Yeah? Procedures for cleanliness. Procedures for utensils, cleaning utensils, etc. Cleaning the body, cleaning utensils, cleaning room. And then meditation and manasa puja and then external puja. All these things are codified into like ritual and rules and regulations. Okay? So if we follow these rules, then we're following Vaidhi Bhakti. For chanting the holy name, no rules. So that anga, in any case, is beyond rules and regulations. But archana is, you could say, all the different angas are mentioned here, that is heavily according to rule and regulation. So when we talk about Vaidhi Bhakti, it often means that. However, there's another aspect of Vaidhi when we talk about Vaidhi Bhakti, and that is that not only following the rules and regulations, but the mood also. So because we follow the rules and regulations or the authority of Shastra, or following orders, we develop an attitude of reverence in our worship by following the rules. So we are worshiping who? We're worshiping the Supreme Lord. And we worship Him according to what the Lord says in the Shastra. So by worshiping in that way, we understand this is God, and I have to worship Him like this according to these so-and-so rules. And if I don't do that, it's offensive. Okay? So there's always recognition of the Lord there. This is the Lord, and He's saying this, and you do this, do this, do this. So by that, we develop an attitude of reverence for the Lord. Yeah? Or, you see, His Aishwarya aspect, or Mahima, His glory, His power. Yeah? So that's an element in Vaidhi, Bhakti. Yeah? A formal perception of the Lord that's very powerful and great. He is the Lord. Yeah? There is another type of mood where we don't have that recognition of the Lord. That's the Raghunuga Bhakti. Yeah? This, however, is not just informal or spontaneous, but it's particularly directed towards Krishna. And not any Krishna, because Krishna and Mathura and Dwarka are also mixed with, they all know He's God. And all the other forms of God also, they know He's God. Rama is God, Nishima is God, everybody knows He's God. So the only form where Krishna, the Lord, is not God, recognized as God, is Krishna in His Vrindavan form. And with those particular people in Raja, they do not see Him as God at all. In other places, there's always an element, this is God. Devaki and Vasudev see Krishna as their son, but also as God. So it's not Raghunuga. And we talk about Raghunuga in relation to the Raja form of Krishna. His mood is a little different. It's very similar, but according to the definition, it's not Raghunuga Bhakti. may make another term for that. I don't know. It's very similar though. It's not exactly like, it's obviously not Aishwarya mode also. But it's not included in this definition. Mahaprabhu, if we worship Lord Chaitanya, can that be called Raghunuga Bhakti? So, here's the definition. That's here in this under 2A, definition of Raghunuga. Rajanti abhivyaktam rajavasi janadi shu ragatmakam anusrita yasa raga nagochate. When the bhakti follows after ragatmaka bhakti, clearly exhibited by the inhabitants of Raja, that's Rajavasi Janadi Shu, and Abhivyakti means very, very clearly expressed, it is called Raghunuga. So therefore, in order to understand what Raghunuga is, we also have to understand what Ragatmaka is, because the definition is following after the Ragatmaka Bhaktis in Bhaktas in Raja, the inhabitants of Raja. So therefore, Rupa Goswami gives a definition of raga and ragatmaka. Yeah? So raga means complete absorption of parama avishtata. And one was completely absorbed in the object of love, ishtesvarasiki. That is called raga. Yeah? Completely absorbed in the object of devotion or object of love. With no regard for God or anything. Yeah? Completely absorbed in it. Yeah? And people that have that type of bhakti, that is called ragatmaka. Yeah? And that ragatmaka bhakti is exhibited by the nityasiddhas in Raja. And they're all completely absorbed in Krishna. They don't see Him as anything except their son, lover, or friend, like that. And they don't see Him as God at all. They're completely absorbed in Him. Good. That's where we go under qualification here. No. Krishna sometimes fools them and says, here I am, I'm God. And then they think, oh, that's not true. It's not actually God. Even Garga Muni came and said, this person, he is like Narayana, and he will always save you. So taking that hint, they could say, oh, he's Narayana. But they don't. Every time Krishna saves them, or when he gets saved from Putana or Agastura, he kills Agastura, and the cowherd boys come back and say, look, Krishna, he's killed Agastura. Then they begin to discuss, oh yes, we remember what Garga Muni said. Somehow or other, he's got this great power because of the mercy of Narayana. So they'll never say he is Narayana, but he's like Narayana, and somehow Narayana is protecting him and us because we've been devotees of Vishnu, so therefore he's protecting us. And then Krishna will sometimes display himself as he did with Mother Yasoda, and she looked in his mouth and she saw all the universes inside. And then afterwards, then she said, oh, there must be something wrong. Some demon must be causing this illusion for me or something to influence the demons. So she called the Brahmins to do some sacrifice to get rid of the evil spirits. Huh? And she won't think of Krishna as God. Yeah? For her love is so strong that she will not see anything. Even if Krishna says, you know, here I am, I'm God, then she will make an excuse and forget about it. So whether the love is very, very strong like this, and there's no regard for God, but only in the relationship of love, then it's called raga. And people that have that are called ragatmaka bhaktas. Huh? And they live in raja. So that's ragatmaka bhaktas. So persons who aspire for that type of love, they are called raganugas. They're very, very intense on getting that similar type of love of those people. Of course, we'll see in Vraja, there's different types of relationship. Yeah? So we know there's five rasas there, five primary rasas, of which Rupa Goswami says Kama Rupa is one. That is, of course, the Madhurya rasa. And all the others are considered Sambandha Rupa. Yeah? So the Kama Rupa is one, that is Madhurya, and all the others are called Sambandha Rupa, or by relationship. And the Kama Nuga, or Kama Rupa, these are the ragatmaka bhaktas. This is that of the gopis in Parakiya rasa. So what is the qualification for raganuga bhakti? Rupa Goswami doesn't go into too much detail here. He says that one has to have this intense greed to attain that type of love of those inhabitants of Raja. So that intense greed should be there. And that is one's qualification. If one doesn't have that, then one is obliged to follow Vaidhi Bhakti. Greed. greed. Like loba. It has to be confirmed by somebody else then. It was on that level. But basically you cannot practice independently also. You get the development by mercy from another person who has such greed. So one can't independently just qualify oneself. And of course, if one is not qualified and one tries, then that is also disqualification. That is dosha, not guna, according to Bhagavatam. Practice according to qualification. Now, of course, there's always a controversy about this because it comes up very prominently, raganuga, in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Basically, it's highly raganuga in its orientation there. And actually, if you don't practice raganuga and you do Vaidhi Bhakti, you can attain Bhav Bhakti and you can also attain Prem Bhakti, but you don't go to Krishna and Raja. You go somewhere else. Yeah? So that's why Lord Chaitanya says that in order to get that Raja Krishna, you have to practice raganuga bhakti. So therefore, it gets a great emphasis by Lord Chaitanya in Chaitanya Charitamrita. And even Bhaktivinoda Thakur has quite a bit of prominence to raganuga bhakti. Okay? But on the other hand, we'll see that Bhaktisiddhanta, and also Bhaktivinoda to some degree, was rather reluctant to discuss it too much. And then he was just reluctant. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati was quite not only reluctant, but he discouraged people from practicing it. And that's how, in Prabhupada also, he kind of discourages us. There's some good reasons for that. With the flow of time from Lord Chaitanya and afterwards, it started out with a lot of raganuga bhakti and less on the vaidhi. And as time went on, we see how that though all intentions were good, there was a decline
in the standards of the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And it got mixed, and then it started getting mixing up with what we call Sahajya, Apasampradaya tendencies, etc. To such an extent that when Bhaktivinoda was around, and Bhaktivinoda Siddhanta were around, Gaudiya Sampradaya had a very bad reputation among respectable people. Because of all the immoral activities going on. Yeah? So because of that tendency, therefore, Bhakti Siddhanta decided that we will have to put a restriction here and not allow this Raghunuga. Raghunuga is not responsible in one sense, that people can abuse it. Huh? The reason abuse is there, one of the reasons, is one can distort the practices. Because in Raghunuga, now of course this Raghunuga means anybody in Braj, but generally Raghunuga concentrates upon the Madhurya Rasa in our Sampradaya, because Lord Chaitanya, Radha Krishna, etc. Yeah? So therefore this aspect of Parakiya Rasa becomes very strong, at least Madhurya Rasa becomes very strong in Gaudiya Sampradaya. Yeah? And then that becomes the object of our practice of Raghunuga Bhakti, in which all this, you know, love affairs of Radha Krishna, etc. Now that is a very high standard. Now, if we have material sentiments, we will project that onto the spiritual love of Radha and Krishna. And we'll have material conceptions of everything. And that pollutes the whole philosophy. And then we'll make excuses for our own material desires. Because they're doing, I can also do. And this is what happened in the Sampradaya. So we find a lot of immorality going on with some of the practices, people practicing. Huh? And then we get whole movements starting out of that, Sahajya movements and things like this. And all very strange practices coming out of this, new concocted ideas they have about the whole system and practice of Raghunuga and other things. So it led to a lot of apasampradayas, and the standards within those who were actually trying to follow also decline and decline. Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati said, okay, we just have to start all over again and start with Vaidhi Bhakti. So he emphasized Vaidhi Bhakti over everything else to set the standards again and to become respectable, because the respect had gone away from the Gaudiya Sampradaya. Yeah. So therefore, the practice is there, but one, of course, is the subject is Radha Krishna, etc. The other is that by nature, it is spontaneous. So therefore, there's less regard for rules. And with less regard for rules, then it's very likely one can lower the standards and lower the standards as time goes on. So therefore, because of this, the lowering the standards plus the idea of Radha Krishna and love affairs, etc., then a lot of contamination set in. So therefore, he said, okay, we have to start all over again and start with Vaidhi as the basic standard. He didn't exclude Raghunuga, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, but he said, let us start with the Vaidhi Bhakti, put a heavy emphasis on that. Then again, for preaching around the world, basically, it is much easier to institute Vaidhi Bhakti, because no real standards for Raghunuga. It's got very free things, so you can't really institute it as an institution, and within an institution also. It's difficult. And therefore, he emphasized the Vaidhi Bhakti for that reason also. Oh, yes. No, if you don't do Raghunuga Bhakti, that is, do Vaidhi Bhakti, and you give, you see Krishna as, let's say we worship Krishna, we see him as God, and then we go to Bhava, and we realize God in that way, he's Krishna, but he's also God, then when you get Prema, you'll also be like that, like Vasudeva and Devaki. So therefore, you don't see Krishna in Raja, you see him somewhere else, in Mathura or Dwarka or somewhere else. Of course, one acharya says that if one is worshipping Vraja Krishna in Vaidhi Bhakti, it would be very illogical one would go to Dwarka or Mathura, because the form is the young Krishna, but still one is worshipping in Vaidhi Bhakti. So he says in that case, you go to another place called Aishwarya Goloka, which is a Vraja form with, in which they worship Krishna as God. Vaidhi Bhakti Krishna. So it's good. The form of Krishna is like Raja Krishna, but you worship him in Vaidhi mode. It's not so spontaneous there.
Yeah, in Vaidhi Bhakti, yes, you understand. Yes. Yeah.
The philosophy we have to have. So this is the problem with Raganuga, the tendency there, because we want to be spontaneous lovers of Krishna, then we don't have regard for philosophy. We don't emphasize it. So Sambandha becomes minimized there. And the danger of that is that then we get all philosophically confused about the whole thing, you know. And we may think we're Nitya Siddhas or whatever, you know. Get all sorts of very strange philosophies coming out of that. Initially, generally, in sadhana bhakti, generally we have to establish Krishna as God, as distinct from everybody else, in order to begin to practice. However, when we advance, and we want to realize Krishna and Vraja, then that idea somehow is overpowered by the love, spontaneous love. But nevertheless, he still is God. So generally we have to have that philosophical basis to begin with. Otherwise, we'll have all sorts of confusions. We can go either Mayavadi or we can go Sahaji or anything, but it will go in the wrong direction. Yes, covered by their love. Particularly, there's some instances in Bhagavatam of the gopis, they see him as Paramatma, etc. So Vishnu Chakravarti explains there, this looks a little bit odd. Because it contradicts their basic mood. He says, when one is in viparlamba, or separation, then this is natural, that one will have all these other ideas coming up. Somehow they'll come up temporarily. Then they'll disappear again later on. So due to the pain of separation, then they'll start thinking like that sometimes. But then when they meet Krishna again, they disappear again. So it may appear temporarily there also, but it's not a permanent idea in their mind. Is that Raganuga or not? As I said, it's kind of similar to it, but it doesn't fit within this definition, because this definition says with the inhabitants of Raja, etc. So it doesn't really get covered. By that. One particular reason probably is because Rupa Goswami is writing for people in general, and Krishna was acceptable, but to say that Gauranga is God may not be acceptable to all people, so therefore he didn't even mention that. But as there are practices that are done like this by some people, where they meditate on the Leela Lord Chaitanya as a daily function, just like they do in Raganuga. They meditate on Krishna getting up in the morning and carrying on his pastimes all day long. But some people do the same for Gauranga also, in the same way. So it's very similar to Raganuga, we can say. And of course, Lord Chaitanya in his Leela also is not being God. He is playing human being. So in that sense, it's also very similar. So we get very, very similar to Raganuga. I don't know if we can call it Raganuga. they're devotees of Lord Chaitanya, yes? But that we say they're expansions of, not actually expansions, we can say they're actually equals in one sense, aren't they? They're another form of them. But in this definition, this Ragatma refers to those in Vraja, not to anybody else. That's why it's a little puzzling how to classify them, but it's very similar. Because Madhurya and Audharja are very similar. Krishna, Leela, and Lord Chaitanya, they're very similar mood. Very, very similar. Except the Audharja one is more, merciful. More preaching element there.
Except
Oh, we're talking about towards Lord Chaitanya. Yeah, obviously they didn't explicitly, because he's appearing as a human being, so therefore nothing is so explicit there also. Towards? Oh. Well, that's an element. Generally, we don't go to Radha Krishna except to Lord Chaitanya anyway. So we would have to establish a relationship with Lord Chaitanya first if we're going to get into Radha Krishna Lila anyway. So definitely have to do that. I see. Yeah. That also, even Lord Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in some degree, also worships Garga Dadhar. That also is like a similar thing to Radha Krishna. And Gauranga and Gadadhar is like Radha Krishna. So that we can say that's the Madhurya Rasa expressed in Lord Chaitanya's Leela. However, it is not explicit as it is in Krishna Leela. Yeah? But the mood is there. So we can say that's the Madhurya Bhava in a covered way in Garga Dadhar. Well, Gauranga is Radha, and Gadadhar is Radha, and Gauranga is Krishna. So it is bona fide in one sense. Yeah, intense greed. Oh, I see. Yeah, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur says something like ruchi. One should have ruchi or something like that, some great taste, and then one is qualified for raganuga. Yeah? So he puts it up there after nishtha, and then you go to ruchi, then you could qualify for raganuga. In Ragvartma Chandrika of Vishwanath, in one place he intimates or indicates somehow that from the very beginning, one could practice raganuga. Beginning stages of bhakti, one could practice raganuga after getting faith. Yeah? Of course, person may be from previous lifetime, may have been qualified already. Yeah? But Bhaktivinoda puts it rather high also, qualification. Raganuga and ragatmaka? Ragatmakas are the eternal associates of the Lord. Raganuga is sadhana bhakti. Nitya siddhas are ragatmakas. Raganuga is a sadhana, sadhaka, who is practicing sadhana bhakti, to get to achieve a bhakti like the ragatmakas. So that means vaidhi bhakti. So actually, since we're doing Pancharatrika worship, that is Vaidhi Bhakti. Yeah? So therefore, we're worshipping them, understanding their God, and with rules and regulations, etc. Yeah? So that's how we practice in Pancharatra worship. Yeah? Yeah. And Raganuga, one can also worship Radha Krishna and Raganuga. It will be very similar in many ways, but the rules are less important, and emotion is more important. Yeah, so basically, as I said, with Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati also, he basically emphasized the Vaidhi Bhakti over everything else. Yeah? Because he saw the effects of what had happened in the Sampradaya due to overemphasis on the raga and then the lowering of standards, etc. Yeah? So for most people to begin with, it is better to practice Vaidhi Bhakti for preaching and for giving people initial standards. Vaidhi Bhakti is easier. Greed. Yeah. So when it's naturally there, then one practices that. Yeah, it'll be obviously a different mood in this practice.
In the Krishna book process, it's kind of like both. Because you can develop love for Nandananda, and then still you hear every different paragraph that he's been both now about it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like Prabhupada just giving the instruction book to complete.
Yeah, yeah. In Krishna book we have all sorts of devotees there also. We have the gopis there, and then we have Yasoda, Nanda, all the people in Vraja. Basically, they're ragatmakas. Yeah? Then we have people outside of Vrindavan, and they are a mixture, Vaidhi Bhakti, etc., like Akura and others. Yeah? They recognize them, but also they recognize the sweetness sometimes, and sometimes they're seeing him as God, etc. All the Rishnis and Yadavas, they see him as their relative, and like that. They also see him as God. Yeah? So therefore, they'll praise him in a more formal way also. But generally the Rajavasis, well, they may sometimes do that, but the predominant mood is that of complete, you know, raga.
Also in my four pastimes, so they're also, it's like Raj.
Yeah, it's equivalent.
Yeah, but then later when Mahaprabhu, after he took sannyas and the devotees of Mahaprabhu, then they kind of see him in the Aishwarya mind.
Yeah. There's his different leelas. Lord Gauranga's leelas are also, we could say, classified like this. The Navadvip leela is like the Raja leela. And the other ones are more formal, yeah, in general. But we also see him exhibiting high standards of ecstasy and puri. But basically there's a little bit more regard for him in these other ones. And in the other place, they don't see him as God at all.
Yeah.
We can simultaneously seem to have two identities in the spiritual world. The reason for that is they're very close, as I said. Lord Chaitanya, the mood of Lord Chaitanya and mood of Krishna are very close. So therefore, we're going to have two separate bodies, so to speak, and simultaneously participate in both leelas. Because of that, they're so close together. In other words, Lord Gauranga is not Aishwarya mood at all, actually. And it's also almost like Madhurya. It's very sweet like that. There's slight differences there. So therefore, they're so close that one can have two forms and simultaneously serve in two bodies, two different forms. Okay, the types of bhakti, of Ragunuga bhakti, are Kamanuga, following after those who have that Kama Rupa bhakti, that is the gopis and manjaris, etc. And the other is Samandanuga, that means all the other relationships like Sakya, Vatsalya, Dasya. What is that? Oh, Kama Rupa. Ah, the gopis offer themselves completely to Krishna. I suppose so. Here, of course, we're Kama Rupa here particularly means the gopis. I'm just saying the gopis. They give up husband, family, children, friends, society, and they say, I'm offering myself completely to Krishna. Of course, everybody in Raja does that in one form or another, but the extreme example is the gopis. They give themselves completely to him in the conjugal rasa. So it particularly refers to the conjugal rasa here. Though everybody gives themselves to Krishna, obviously, otherwise you couldn't be in the spiritual world. So that means completely they give themselves in conjugal rasa. And similarly, the Kamanugas are the gopis. It means the gopis again. But this, of course, is sadhana. So they're not at that stage, actually. But they're following after the conjugal, the people in conjugal rest, that's the gopis and the manjaris. They follow after them. So that's called Kamanuga Bhakti. Under Raghunuga, Kamanuga. So one can aspire directly to be a gopi or to follow after them, which is basically what we do. We follow after in our sampradaya. We don't try to become a sakhi or anything like that. At best, you follow to aspire and become a manjari, who are followers of the gopis. They're generally interchangeable. But of course, gopi can also refer to older gopis, like Yasoda is even a gopi. Those are elder gopis. So Sakya generally means like on the level of Radha and the younger persons. So how does one qualify for Kamanuga? If one develops desire for this type of mood, on seeing Krishna's deity or hearing about it, etc. Huh? Somehow one develops that sort of mood. Huh? And the other ones are all called Sambandhanuga. But one should not think of oneself as that eternal associate. One follows after them. So one cannot aspire to be Radha or Nanda or Yasoda or anything like that. That's offensive. The Angas are the same as Vaidhi Bhakti in general. The same Angas. In other words, Archana is there. Hearing is there. All the bodily Angas are there. Everything, Pranama, all the same thing. So in one sense, it's not visibly different. Because the same angas are there. The emphasis will be a little different. Because the emphasis is on remembrance of the Krishna's pastimes, etc. And developing a taste for Vrajalila. So therefore they'll be more involved with hearing the pastimes of Krishna and remembering and meditating on the pastimes of Krishna. And related to that, they have what is called the remembering the eightfold pastimes of the Lord. Now, the day is divided into eight parts from early morning until next morning. And then Krishna has typical activities he follows throughout the day, from getting up in the morning and bathing and milking the cows and taking breakfast and going out in the fields, taking his lunch. Broke? It's melting in Prema. So anyway, they meditate on the pastimes of the Lord throughout the day and their relationship with Krishna throughout the day in those different pastimes, either in association or in separation. That's called the Astakaliya Leela. So there's various padatis based on those leelas. Krishna's Govinda Lilamrita is there, and Kavi Karnapur has written one also, and a few others have written. It comes from Padma Purana, actually, the original, and then based on that, they've expanded that a little bit. So anyway, they concentrate on the daily Lila of Krishna and their service to Krishna during the whole day. So that's quite a lot of in the mind also. So one has to have a very controlled mind to do this. One in Raghunuga generally tries to live in Vrindavan. He wants to live in Raja. And as I said, he's meditating on the pastimes of the Lord. And there is what is called the getting one Siddha Rupa. That is, the guru gives one a form of a certain gopa or gopi or whatever in the spiritual according to rasa, and then you meditate on that and meditate on your service to Krishna in that form. That's a siddha rupa. So this is what the Babaji's give. They give you a siddha rupa and then you practice. So they consider that the real initiation. This, however, was discouraged by Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati as being very mechanical. And even Gaur Kishore also said, rather mechanical process, because we can't guarantee that these people are going to develop anything simply by getting this initiation, if they're not qualified. So therefore, getting the initiation is not some sort of authorization that you're at a certain level at all.
one should be highly qualified in order to utilize that properly. So therefore, it was not so much neither Gorky Shore nor Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati was in favor of that type of initiation because it was rather mechanical. And Gorky Shore also said that simply by chanting Hare Krishna, eventually that form will reveal itself. Anyway, your true form. Yeah? So you don't have to get it artificially from someone else. So externally, the one in Raga Nuga will be very similar to the Vaidhi Bhakta, and he should do very similar activities. And there's no permission for him not to follow either. So externally, he should be just like a Vaidhi Bhakta. But internally, his mood will be much different because he's trying to develop this spontaneous mood for Krishna. However, externally it may be manifest in the form of less regard for rules in the form of worship, etc. In worship, for instance, in deity worship, we have to be punctual, etc. So there may be less regard for punctuality. Or they may change at different times, because like in the summertime it is too hot to offer ghee lamps. So they won't offer ghee lamps to Krishna because it's too hot for him. Maybe Krishna's going to get too hot and he's doing this for 20 minutes with a fire all around him. What's the point? We're trying to please Krishna, so therefore we won't offer like that. Or according to the season they'll offer different, do different things which are more convenient. So in this way they'll be a little more free. Of course, the danger there is that then one can relax all sorts of things on the basis of that we don't have to be so clean, we don't have to do anything, because it's all, Krishna takes our bhava, our emotion instead. So this becomes the danger, that we'll do this and then standards begin to fall. If one is on a high level, it doesn't matter. One is not bound by any rules and regulations on bhava and prema. There's no problem there. So we see that apparently some of these very elevated devotees don't follow the rules like anybody else. They don't treat their deities like anyone else. They may carry the deities under their arm and bathe them in the river and pull them out like that. And they don't follow any rules. But that's a very high standard. So on the lower levels, we have to train ourselves. So therefore, we have to follow the Vaidhi level. And you can't artificially imitate that level. What is the cause? Cause of Raghunut? It cannot artificially be induced to develop that greed for Krishna, which is the qualification. Yeah? Only by association and mercy. Yeah? Through that association that one can develop. If someone has that taste and greed, and one associates with him through hearing, etc., and then one can also develop that mood, same mood. Okay. Question. Kaliya Leela. That means Leela according to 8 parts of the day. Our deity worship is according to that. We're to some degree, because we wake up Krishna in the morning and we dress him and feed him like that. There's more details, obviously. For instance, in the Madhurya Leela at least, Radharani and the gopis, they come and they cook for Krishna in the morning and they make, hundreds of preparations and everything like that. All particular preparations. They lay them out in a very attractive manner and all sorts of tables and leaves and etc. like that. And then Krishna lines up with all of his boyfriends and they all take together in a joking mood. And then later, Krishna goes out and he calls his friends and they all gather together in the village and they all come together like that. And then they all start going out into the fields. Then they play in the fields for some time. And then when they're hungry, they take a meal. But then Krishna will disappear
So I'm going off to find some cows, and he'll disappear for 2 hours. And then he'll go and meet Radha, the gopis, and they'll have some pastimes there. And he'll come back again in the afternoon and say, oh, you know, I just got the cows now and brought them back. And then they'll all go back again. They'll play around, and then they'll come back into the village. And meanwhile, all the people of Raja are in great anxiety about Krishna, and they're waiting for him to come home. And they go to the top of the roof, on the roofs, and they're looking for the dust, the signs of the dust on the horizon like that. Huh? And then finally Krishna begins to come into the village like that, and then he comes in, and the Mother Yasoda takes them and bathes them, decorates them again, and sits them down for his meal with Nanda Maharaj. Like that. Then later on, Krishna has some relaxation like that. Then he goes to bed. Then he gets up and goes out in the middle of the night and meets the gopis and has Rasalila and everything. Then he comes back in the morning again and goes to bed, and then Mother Yasoda wakes him up. Yeah. Uh-huh, I see. Yeah. Well, what happens is Krishna, he takes with him, each of the cowherd boys takes with him a lunch. Yeah, everything, they pack it up into packages and they carry it in little cloths and they take it out with them. And then at noontime, they open all the packages up and they, well, they play around and throw it at each other also. And play with it and then eat it also. And they feed each other, etc. So they have their own meal also. Well, they cook in the morning and evening. And especially in the morning, Radha comes over and cooks with all the gopis. They cook and then feed Krishna there. So he has a big pile of prasada in the morning. I guess not prasada, bhoga. They offer to him.
What is the relationship for the sadhaka, the relationship with the relationship that he has with the Bhikshu Guru and the practice of other means?
If you're assuming he's a different guru, or
no, the Bhikshu Guru.
What
has the relationship that he has with the Bhikshu Guru and the practice?
But are you assuming that his Raganuga Guru is different or something? Or what? Maybe a different guru. Could be the same. Now, traditionally, it would be the same in Gaudiya. In other words, he would give you the mantra, worship the deity, and he may give you, be the Raganuga Guru also. Huh? Like that with the Babaji's, for instance. They'll give you mantra, and they also give you Rupa, all that. So they would be both. They would be a Diksha Guru plus a Raganuga Guru. Huh? And probably, I'm not so sure, but probably also in these other lines that are in Bengal of the different associates, you know, they come down. Like Raghunandan Thakur or whatever line is there, Abhiram Thakur, etc. They would probably do the same thing. They would give Diksha, plus they would carry out the Raghunuga sadhana also. So the Diksha Guru and the Raghunuga person would be the same. Other cases may be different. One may get Diksha from someone and then develop Raghunuga later on and take from someone else. And then there's a case like, was it Hridoy Chaitanya? Or Shamananda. He got a Sakya relationship from his guru, and then he went to Raja, and through Jiva Goswami, he started developing more Madhurya sentiments there. So, a little switch over of a guru there, a little bit. But even his first guru was also Raga in one sense, because it was Sakya Rasa. So, both were the same Raga Nuga. If they are different, then one should probably take permission from the first guru to get proceed to Raghunuga, yeah? From a different person. One should, that would be the etiquette. Just as if one is to take shiksha, which is also Raghunuga shiksha in one sense also. Huh? If one takes shiksha from someone, one should take permission from the diksha guru.
What about, they're meditating on the Raga Sika.
Hmm.
So that's kind of like they're following the Raga Sika. The question is kind of like the guru and disciple relationship, how does that fit in? You know, because they're just following the Rajavasis, basically. So
What does the guru do?
There's no gurus in Raj. So they're in the Rajat mood. So, you know, like,
what the guru actually teaches you all about the service. Huh? And of course, in strictly in this Raganuga line where they get a rupa, the guru gives them a form. If they're a Manjari, for instance, they get a form, color of their dress, the service they do, the group of gopis they're in, all the different 11 elements of that. Yeah? And they get all those details or whatever. And that constitutes their, you know, siddha pranali. That's a siddha pranali. Yeah? And then related to that, then they will have stories, etc., and discuss Rasa-lila or whatever, different lilas of Krishna. So basically, they'll help them develop that mood. That's all that's open to us right now. And that's something naturally that happens by chanting Hare Krishna, I suppose. And of course, reading the literature, Bhagavatam, etc., by doing that. And if some devotees are on that level, then one gets association with them and gets similarly inspired. Within our own sampradaya, basically, though theoretically one could have Sakya Rasa, Madhurya Rasa, Dasya Rasa, Vatsalya Rasa, all of them would be there. We don't see anything except the Manjari mood, actually. And it looks like there was a little Sakya mood also, apparently. But it seems to have died out. There's a few books written on that, but not much. Nothing on Vatsalya, nothing on Dasya. Mainly on the Manjari Bhav, written by several people like John Chandra. So one has to be in a Vatsalya mood. There would be no one to take shelter of, even theoretically, because there's no works written on that. Huh? Except we got the Bhagavatam, of course, and then you follow after it, Nanda and Yasoda. In the other sampradaya, of course, there is. That is the Vallabha sampradaya. And Rupa Goswami mentions that and he calls it Pushti Marga. Raghunu can also be called Pushti Marga. And the Vallabhas, they follow that, and which is very similar to this Raghunu. But their deity is usually baby Krishna, and it's a Vatsalya mood. So they're predominantly Vatsalya and their Rasa. It appears like that, according to Jiva Dharma, where the guru, he gives a Manjari relationship to one of his disciples, and he gives a Sakya relationship to someone else. So it appears that he would, you know, give them all. Yeah? But then, as I said, we don't have any literatures really devoted to Sakya Rasa or whatever. Yeah? Well, we have a lot of devoted to the Madhurya Rasa. The Siddha Rupena means that form of the Siddha. In other words, one meditates as a sadhana on one's form in the spiritual world, whether it's the gopi or a elder gopi or a whatever. No? In other words, this Siddha Pranali thing. Huh? Yeah. And that's the Siddha Rupa. Huh? That would be your external form now. But then I think also has something to do with, let me see. It means external, internal. So the internal form, one meditates on that as an associate of the Lord, eternal associate of the Lord, or is aspiring for that. And then sadhaka rupa, one follows externally, just like in Vaidhi Bhakti, the angas of bhakti, which are mentioned there. Of course, one sense it's all included in the form also. I do like the name. The name includes the form, the qualities, the activities, and the rasa. But then, everybody's using the same name, but they can also get a different goal in terms of their different rasas. Huh? So one person can get up to Sakya Rasa by the same name as Madhurya Rasa, whatever, it's the same Hare Krishna mantra, but you could get any of the different rasas through that. Huh? Depending on one's own consciousness and attraction. So, in other words, the Krishna is there, but it may be a particular form of Krishna that we meditate on. And one is ideal for Madhurya, one is ideal for Vatsalya, and one is ideal for Sakya. Yeah, a little different. And the mood would also be different. So the same name, it can be useful, and we can develop different realizations of Krishna with the same name. Which is not so with mantra. The mantra is quite specific. Yeah? So our mantra is basically conjugal rasa. Yeah? And it's specifically conjugal rasa. The name could be anything. So it has Radha Krishna in it, and the mantra and Hare and Krishna still. Even the gopas, and they're also in fraternal rasa with Krishna, they also worship Radha and Krishna. So technically the holy name could be used for all rasas, whereas the mantra is specifically for Madhurya rasa. On what? Raghunuga and... Well, we can blame Bhaktisiddhanta then also. Because it's originally started by Bhaktisiddhanta that he actually discouraged too much emphasis on the Raghunuga. If one is qualified, one can take. So therefore, when he emphasized Vaidhi Bhakti, then that is implicit there, the idea that not many people are qualified. So in Bhaktivinoda's time, or in Bhaktisiddhanta's time, not many people he didn't think were qualified. What to speak of now? Even less people are qualified. And so justified in not emphasizing it too much. And times are more degraded. But it is there, nevertheless, as I said, the whole Chaitanya Charitamrita basically is very raga influenced, heavily raga nuga. And Prabhupada presented that, so it's there. But when, you know, one has to be qualified to see it also and appreciate it.
The family members told me that Shivabhi Saranda instructed his disciples in his learning after that in Dasavas to tell us that he is, and he said to them, you're not qualified to receive this yet, but it's the property of that sort of idea. And then he just told them something, you know, confidential knowledge.
Not public. Yeah, yeah. Similarly, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had, though he had fights with the Babaji's in Vrindavan, etc., still he also had a few Babaji disciples also. So it's not that he, you know, forbade Babaji or that. He had some Babaji disciples also. But, it was like rare. It wasn't so common. Okay, I think we can probably end there. Just do the rest tomorrow. Okay, Hare Krishna.